Passage 28.
No two sorts of birds practice quite the same sort of flight. The varieties are infinite, but two classes may be roughly seen. Any ship that crosses the Pacific is accompanied for many days by the smaller albatross, which may keep company with the vessel for an hour without visible or more than occasional movement of wing. The currents of air that the walls of the ship direct upwards, as well as in the line of its course, are enough to give the great bird with its immense wings sufficient sustenance and progress. The albatross is the king of the gliders, the class of flyers which harness the air to their purpose, but must yield to its opposition. In the contrary school, the duck is supreme. It comes nearer to the engines with which man has conquered the air, as he boasts. Duck, and like them the pigeons, are endowed with steel-like muscles that are a good part of the weight of the bird, and these will ply the short wings with irresistible power that can bear them for long distances through an opposite gale before exhaustion follows. Their humbler followers, such as partridges, have a like power of strong propulsion, but soon tire. You may pick them up in utter exhaustion if wind over the sea has driven them to a long journey. The swallow shares the virtues of both schools in highest measure. It tires not, nor does it boast of its power, but belongs to the air, travelling it may be 6,000 miles to and from its northern nesting home, feeding its flown young as it flies, and slipping through a medium that seems to help its passage, even when the wind is adverse. Such birds do us good, though we no longer take omens from the flight on this side and that, and even the most superstitious villagers no longer take off their hats to the magpie and wish it good morning. William Beach Thomas, A Countryman's Creed. Passage 29.
A young man sees a sunset, and, unable to understand or to express the emotion that it rouses in him, concludes that it must be the gateway to a world that lies beyond. It's difficult for any of us in moments of intense aesthetic experience to resist the suggestion that we are catching a glimpse of a light that shines down to us from a different realm of existence. Different and, because the experience is intensely moving, in some way higher. And though the gleams blind and dazzle, yet do they convey a hint of beauty and serenity greater than we have known or imagined. Greater too than we can describe, for language, which was invented to convey the meanings of this world, cannot readily be fitted to the uses of another. That all great art has this power of suggesting a world beyond is undeniable. In some moods, nature shares it. There is no sky in June so blue that it does not point forward to a bluer, no sunset so beautiful that it does not waken the vision of a greater beauty, a vision which passes before it is fully glimpsed, and in passing leaves an indefinable longing and regret. But if this world is not merely a bad joke, life a vulgar flare amid the cool radiance of the stars, and existence an empty laugh braying across the mysteries, if these intimations of a something behind and beyond are not evil humour born of indigestion or whimsies sent by the devil to mock and madden us, if, in a word, beauty means something, yet we must not seek to interpret the meaning. If we glimpse the unutterable, it is unwise to try to utter it, nor should we seek to invest with significance that which we cannot grasp. Beauty in terms of our human meaning is meaningless. C. A. M. Jode, Pieces of Mind. Passage 30.
Each civilization is born, it culminates, and it decays. There is a widespread testimony that this ominous fact is due to inherent biological defects in the crowded life of cities. Now, slowly and at first faintly, an opposite tendency is showing itself. Better roads and better vehicles at first induce the wealthier classes to live on the outskirts of the cities. The urgent need for defense had also vanished. This tendency is now spreading rapidly downwards, but a new set of conditions is just showing itself. Up to the present time, throughout the 18th and 19th centuries, this new tendency placed the home in the immediate suburbs, but concentrated manufacturing activity, business relations, government, and pleasure in the center of the cities. Apart from the care of children and periods of sheer rest, the active lives were spent in the cities. In some ways, the concentration of such activities was even more emphasized, and the homes were pushed outwards, even at the cost of the discomfort of commuting. But, if we examine the trend of technology during the past generation, the reasons for this concentration are largely disappearing. Still more, the reasons for the choice of sites for cities are also altering. Mechanical power can be transmitted for hundreds of miles. Men can communicate almost instantaneously by telephone. The chiefs of great organizations can be transported by airplanes. The cinemas can produce plays in every village. Music, speeches, and sermons can be broadcast. Almost every reason for the growth of cities, concurrently with the growth of civilization, has been profoundly modified. A. N. Whitehead, Adventures of Ideas. Part 2, Unit 4, Passage 31.
Many people in industry and the services who have practical experience of noise regard any investigation of this question as a waste of time. They're not prepared even to admit the possibility that noise affects people. On the other hand, those who dislike noise will sometimes use most inadequate evidence to support their pleas for a quieter society. This is a pity, because noise abatement really is a good cause, and it's likely to be discredited if it gets to be associated with bad science. One allegation often made is that noise produces mental illness. A recent article in a weekly newspaper, for instance, was headed with a striking illustration of a lady in a state of considerable distress with the caption, "She was yet another victim reduced to a screaming wreck." On turning eagerly to the text, one learns that the lady was a typist who found the sound of office typewriters worried her more and more until eventually she had to go into a mental hospital. Now, the snag in this sort of anecdote is, of course, that one cannot distinguish cause and effect. Was the noise a cause of the illness? Or were the complaints about noise merely a symptom? Another patient might equally well complain that her neighbors were combining to slander her and persecute her. And yet one might be cautious about believing this statement. What is needed in the case of noise is a study of large numbers of people living under noisy conditions to discover whether they are mentally ill more often than other people are. The United States Navy, for instance, recently examined a very large number of men working on aircraft carriers. The study was known as Project Anahim. It can be unpleasant to live even several miles from an aerodrome if you think what it must be like to share the deck of a ship with several squadrons of jet aircraft. You will realize that a modern navy is a good place to study noise. But neither psychiatric interviews nor objective tests were able to show any effects upon these American sailors. This result merely confirms earlier American and British studies. If there is any effect of noise upon mental health, it must be so small that present methods of psychiatric diagnosis cannot find it. That does not prove that it does not exist, but it does mean that noise is less dangerous than, say, being brought up in an orphanage, which really is a mental health hazard. D.E. Broadbent, Non-Auditory Effects of Noise from Science Survey. Passage 32.
It is animals and plants which lived in or near water whose remains are most likely to be preserved, for one of the necessary conditions of preservation is quick burial, and it is only in the seas and rivers, and sometimes lakes, where mud and silt have been continuously deposited, that bodies and the like can be rapidly covered over and preserved. But even in the most favorable circumstances, only a small fraction of the creatures that die are preserved in this way before decay sets in, or, even more likely, before scavengers eat them. After all living creatures live by feeding on something else, whether it be plant or animal, dead or alive, and it is only by chance that such fate is avoided. The remains of plants and animals that lived on land are much more rarely preserved, for there is seldom anything to cover them over. When you think of the innumerable birds that one sees flying about, not to mention the equally numerous small animals like field mice and voles, which you do not see, it is very rarely that one comes across a dead body, except, of course, on the roads. They decompose and are quickly destroyed by the weather or eaten by some other creature. It is almost always due to some very special circumstances that traces of land animals survive, as by falling into inaccessible caves or into an ice crevice, like the Siberian mammoths, when the whole animal is sometimes preserved, as in a refrigerator. This is what happened to the famous Beresovka mammoth, which was found preserved and in good condition. In his mouth were the remains of fir trees, the last meal that he had before he fell into the crevice and broke his back. The mammoth has now been restored in the Paleontological Museum in Leningrad. Other animals were trapped in tar pits, like the elephants, saber-toothed cats, and numerous other creatures that are found at Rancho La Brea, which is now just a suburb of Los Angeles. Apparently, what happened was that water collected on these tar pits, and the bigger animals, like the elephants, ventured out onto the apparently firm surface to drink and were promptly bogged in the tar. And then, when they were dead, the carnivores, like the saber-toothed cats and the giant wolves, came out to feed and suffered exactly the same fate. There are also endless numbers of birds in the tar as well. Errol White, The Past Life of the Earth, from Discovery. Passage 33.
From the 17th century empire of Sweden, the story of a galleon that sank at the start of her maiden voyage in 1628 must be one of the strangest tales of the sea. For nearly 3.5 centuries, she lay at the bottom of Stockholm Harbour until her discovery in 1956. This was the Vasa, royal flagship of the great imperial fleet. King Gustavus Adolphus, the Northern Hurricane, then at the height of his military success in the 30 Years' War, had dictated her measurements and armament. Triple gun decks mounted 64 bronze cannon, she was intended to play a leading role in the growing might of Sweden. As she was prepared for her maiden voyage on August the 10th, 1628, Stockholm was in ferment. As she was prepared for her maiden voyage on August the 10th, 1628, Stockholm was in a ferment. From the Skeppsbron and surrounding islands, the people watched this thing of beauty begin to spread her sails and catch the wind. They had labored for 3 years to produce this floating work of art. She was more richly carved and ornamented than any previous ship. The high stern castle was a riot of carved gods, demons, knights, kings, warriors, mermaids, cherubs, and zoomorphic animal shapes ablaze with red and gold and blue, symbols of courage, power, and cruelty, were portrayed to stir the imaginations of the superstitious sailors of the day. Then the cannons of the anchored warships thundered a salute, to which the Vasa fired in reply. As she emerged from her drifting cloud of gun smoke, with the water churned to foam beneath her bow, her flags flying, pennants waving, sails filling in the breeze, and the red and gold of her superstructure ablaze with colour, she presented a more majestic spectacle than Stockholmers had ever seen before. Old gun ports were open, and the muzzles peeped wickedly from them. As the wind freshened, there came a sudden squall, and the ship made a strange movement listing to port. The ordnance officer ordered all the port cannon to be heaved to starboard to counteract the list, but the steepening angle of the decks increased. Then the sound of rumbling thunder reached the watchers on the shore, as cargo, ballast, ammunition, and 400 people went sliding and crashing down to the port side of the steeply listing ship. The lower gun ports were now below water, and the inrush sealed the ship's fate. In that first glorious hour, the mighty Vasa, which was intended to rule the Baltic, sank with all flags flying in the harbour of her birth. Roy Saunders, The Raising of the Vasa, from The Listener. Passage 34.
This is a sceptical age, but although our faith in many of the things in which our forefathers fervently believed has weakened, our confidence in the curative properties of the bottle of medicine remains the same as theirs. This modern faith in medicines is proved by the fact that the annual drug bill of the health services is mounting to astronomical figures and shows no signs at present of ceasing to rise. The majority of the patients attending the medical outpatients departments of our hospitals feel that they have not received adequate treatment unless they are able to carry home with them some tangible remedy in the shape of a bottle of medicine, a box of pills, or a small jar of ointment. And the doctor in charge of the department is only too ready to provide them with these requirements. There is no quicker method of disposing of patients than by giving them what they are asking for, And since most medical men in the health services are overworked and have little time for offering time-consuming and little appreciated advice on such subjects as diet, right living, and the need for abandoning bad habits, etc., the bottle, the box, and the jar are almost always granted them. Nor is it only the ignorant and ill-educated person who has such faith in the bottle of medicine, especially if it be wrapped in white paper and sealed with a dab of red sealing wax by a clever chemist. It is recounted of Thomas Carlyle that when he heard of the illness of his friend, Henry Taylor, he went off immediately to visit him, carrying with him in his pocket what remained of a bottle of medicine formerly prescribed for an indisposition of Mrs. Carlyle's. Carlyle was entirely ignorant of what the bottle in his pocket contained, of the nature of the illness from which his friend was suffering, and of what had previously been wrong with his wife. But a medicine that had worked so well in one form of illness would surely be of equal benefit in another. And comforted by the thought of the help he was bringing to his friend, he hastened to Henry Taylor's house. History does not relate whether his friend accepted his medical help, but in all probability he did. The great advantage of taking medicine is that it makes no demands on the taker beyond that of putting up for a moment with a disgusting taste, and that is what all patients demand of their doctors, to be cured at no inconvenience to themselves. Kenneth Walker, Patients and Doctors. Passage 35.
Many strange new means of transport have been developed in our century, the strangest of them being perhaps the hovercraft. In 1953, a former electronics engineer in his 50s, Christopher Cockerell, who had turned to boat building on the Norfolk Broads, suggested an idea on which he'd been working for many years to the British government and industrial circles. It was the idea of supporting a craft on a pad or cushion of low-pressure air, ringed with a curtain of high-pressure air. Ever since, people have had difficulty in deciding whether the craft should be ranged among ships, planes, or land vehicles, or is something in between a boat and an aircraft. As a shipbuilder, Cockerell was trying to find a solution to the problem of the wave resistance, which wastes a good deal of a surface ship's power and limits its speed. His answer was to lift the vessel out of the water by making it ride on a cushion of air, no more than 1 or 2 feet thick. This is done by a great number of ring-shaped air jets on the bottom of the craft. It flies, therefore, but it cannot fly higher. Its action depends on the surface, water or ground over which it rides. The first tests on the Solent in 1959 caused a sensation. The hovercraft travelled first over the water, then mounted the beach, climbed up the dunes, and sat down on a road. Later it crossed the channel, riding smoothly over the waves, which presented no problem. Since that time, various types of hovercraft have appeared and taken up regular service. Cruises on the Thames in London, for instance, have become an annual attraction. But we are only at the beginning of a development that may transform sea and land transport. Christopher Cockerell's craft can establish transport networks in large areas with poor communications, such as Africa or Australia. It can become a flying fruit bowl carrying bananas from the plantations to the ports. Giant hovercraft liners could span the Atlantic, and the railways of the future may well be the hover train riding on its air cushion over a single rail, which it never touches at speeds up to 300 miles per hour. The possibilities appear unlimited. Egon Larsen, The Pegasus Book of Inventors. Passage 36.
Our knowledge of the oceans 100 years ago was confined to the two-dimensional shape of the sea surface and the hazards of navigation presented by the irregularities in depth of the shallow water close to the land. The open sea was deep and mysterious, and anyone who gave more than a passing thought to the bottom confines of the oceans probably assumed that the seabed was flat. Sir James Clark Ross had obtained a sounding of over 2,400 fathoms in 1839. But it was not until 1869, when HMS Porcupine was put at the disposal of the Royal Society for several cruises, that a series of deep soundings was obtained in the Atlantic, and the first samples were collected by dredging the bottom. Shortly after this, the famous HMS Challenger expedition established the study of the sea floor as a subject worthy of the most qualified physicists and geologists. A burst of activity associated with the laying of submarine cables soon confirmed the Challenger's observation that many parts of the ocean were 2 to 3 miles deep, and the existence of underwater features of considerable magnitude. Today, enough soundings are available to enable a relief map of the Atlantic to be drawn, and we know something of the great variety of the seabed's topography. Since the sea covers the greater part of the Earth's surface, it is quite reasonable to regard the seafloor as the basic form of the crust of the Earth, with, superimposed upon it, the continents, together with the islands and other features of the oceans. The continents form rugged tablelands, which stand nearly 3 miles above the floor of the open ocean. From the shoreline, out to a distance which may be anywhere from a few miles to a few hundred miles, runs the gentle slope of the continental shelf, geologically part of the continents. The real dividing line between continents and oceans occurs at the foot of a steeper slope. This continental slope usually starts at a place somewhere near the 100-fathom mark, and in the course of a few hundred miles reaches the true ocean floor at 2,500 to 3,000 fathoms. The slope averages about 1 in 30, but contains steep, probably vertical, cliffs and gentle sediment-covered terraces. And near its lower reaches, there is a long tailing off, which is almost certainly the result of material transported out to deep water after being eroded from the continental masses. T. F. Gaskell, Exploring the Sea Floor, from Science Survey. Passage 37.
The Victorians, realizing that the greatest happiness accorded to man is that provided by a happy marriage, endeavoured to pretend that all their marriages were happy. We, for our part, admitting the fact that no feat of intelligence and character is so exacting as that required of two people who desire to live permanently together on a basis of amity, are obsessed by the problem of how to render the basic facts of cohabitation simpler and more reasonable, in order that unhappy marriages may less frequently result. The Victorians would have considered it painful or unpleasant were one to point out that only 4 marriages out of every 10 are anything but forced servitudes. We ourselves start from this very assumption and try to build from it a theory of more sensible relations between the sexes. Of all forms of arrant untruthfulness, Victorian optimism appears to me to have been the most cowardly and the most damaging. Truth, therefore, is an attitude of the mind. It's important, if one does not wish to inconvenience and to bore one's friends, not to tell lies. But it's more important not to think lies or to slide into those mechanical and untruthful habits of thought which are so pleasant and so easy as descents to mental ineptitude. The Victorian habit of mind, which I consider to have been a bad habit of mind, were unduly preoccupied by what was socially and morally convenient. Convenience is, however, in all affairs of life, an execrable test of value. One should have the courage to think uncomfortably, since it is only by rejecting the convenience that one can come to think the truth. Not, after all, that there is any such thing as truth. At best, we can approach to some relative approximation. On the other hand, there is surely such a thing as untruth. One is generally aware, when one has said something or acted in some way, which has left on other people an impression not strictly in accordance with the facts. One is generally aware also when one has thrust aside an inconvenient thought and slid into its place another thought which is convenient. One's awareness in the former case is in general more acute than in the latter, since we are more on the lookout for the lies we utter than for those we merely think. In fact, however, it is the untruthful thought which is the more vicious of the two. Spoken lies are invariably tiresome and may actually be dishonest. But continuous lying in the mind, a disease to which the Anglo-Saxon is peculiarly exposed, spells the destruction of human thought and character. Harold Nicholson, On Telling the Truth, from Small Talk.